Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Paul Tobin. You know him as the writer of My Date with Monsters from Aftershock Comic Books. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Tobin. Welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. I'm glad to have you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. So I always get to read your work, and it's fantastic. I've definitely enjoyed your current work, My Date with Monsters. It's a pleasure to read it.
Thank you.
So in reading that book, I couldn't help but think, what inspired that book to get made? Because it's a fascinating read. I really like it. It's unique as hell.
Yeah, it's got a few genres to it, I'd have to say. It originally stemmed from, I just really love the combination of genres. And I've had a love affair with Japanese yokai in particular for a long time. And then the monsters across the world. Japan has like a really good tradition of monsters, and they seem to have like quirkier ones. So they've always been in my head. And then my friend Patrick Reynolds asked if I wanted to do a project together. And that project kind of fell through, but My Date with Monsters kind of built from there because the ideas were in my head. And the idea of the dream world is always important to me. I tend to have dream worlds in some of my horror work because I feel like the waking line is kind of small. And I'm a guy who has quite a few nightmares and quite a few dreams. And, you know, there's always those moments when you wake up from a nightmare and you're kind of breathing hard and going, okay, is this real? Okay, I'm not on a train falling through space. So apparently it's not real. But part of the dream world kind of like worked its way in. And then so many internet lists about the horrors of dating, and like a lot of my single friends like talking about, oh, you will not believe this person and things like that. And so the combination of the horror of the monsters and the horror of just interpersonal human relationships with romance as the standby here kind of like all coalesced in my head into this project.
Well, I'm going to interrupt the fluidity of the interview just for 1 second and point out your background is freaking awesome. Are those original artwork?
Yeah, I collect original art. I have
that's a badass like, background.
There's like 200 or 300 pieces of art up in my place.
Oh my God.
I forget what's back there. Yeah, there's an original Graham Ingalls EC page there and a Stan Goldberg Millie the Model. You might to see a Jack Kirby Captain America page back there, a Richard Sala page. I'm a huge Sala fan, so.
That is absolutely amazing. I love original artwork. I can't ever afford it because, you know, teacher salary, but that is.
I can't afford it anymore. The prices are just insane. There's no way I could afford my collection.
Well,
like I'm really old, so like, I have a Frank Miller Daredevil page, and you know, if somebody offered me $60,000 for it, I'd say no.
Jesus.
I remember buying it for $75.
So. Oh my God. Well, if I remember correctly, there was in the news about a week ago, maybe 3 days ago, there was the original page of the first retroactive appearance of Venom, or at least Spider-Man in the black costume, went for seven figures at an auction.
Almost $3.5 million. Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah, your Frank Miller one is probably going worth better than 60 nowadays.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I've been watching, like, it's fun in one way to watch the prices of my original art go up, but also I don't have any intention of selling, so what they're worth isn't that important to me. But the bad part of it is, like you say, I can't afford this stuff anymore. Like, there's very few pages in my collection that if they went up for sale today at the prices they would get, that I wouldn't even think about getting. It's weird.
Yeah, there's a website I go on to buy comics sometimes called mycomicshop.com, because the local shop doesn't carry back issues. And every once when they have an auction, they always, sometimes they have original artwork. So just for fun, I'm like, I'll put in $60, you know? And I'm looking at like, and for 2 days, it's the winning bet. I'm like, holy shit, can you get for six? And then it ends up like $1,000, like, oh, whatever.
Right, yeah.
I was like, for 2 days, I was so excited. And then it's like,
I go through that all the time myself.
it's really disappointing, but yeah. Original artwork is definitely well priced to me. It's it's amazing how what was definitely an outcast fat widow thing of the comic books was like the outcast, the geek thing, you know, the basement mm-hmm. thing that you kept has now become so mainstream that it's been priced out of the wallets of those who used to buy that's the collection. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, I have a collection of, like, Golden Age comics and like key Marvels, and there's no way I could afford to have those anymore yeah. either to buy those. I mean, I'm glad I got the ones that I got. I mean, I have some really nice ones, but yeah, I couldn't come close to affording them anymore.
No, I have, I think three Golden Age comic books that I was able to buy. Cause once, I mean, I'll say I bought them at auction, stuff like that. Two were Captain Marvel or, you know, Shazam. Mm-hmm. And one was an EC combo. I can't remember the name of it. It was like mm-hmm. 1950, like 1952, something like that. And I think I spent $50 on each of them, and they're so cherished.
Yeah. Yeah, I love them. I love the Fawcett comics too, the Captain Marvel ones and things like that. And I probably have maybe 200 or 300 Golden Age, and then probably like maybe 10 of what I would consider like key Marvels, FF1, Avengers 1, first Daredevil, first Iron Man, stuff like that.
Well, definitely hide your address, because your house apparently very valuable right now. it's like a gold mine in your place.
I have a lot of knives around. I will defend my loves.
Oh my god, if there's ever anyone breaks into my house, first I'll protect my wife because I'm on camera and I gotta say that, but number two, mm-hmm. comic books, and then the pets.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at too. And I have to say wife because she's just literally sitting right over there, so
she's watching. She's like, right answer, motherfucker,
right answer.
But you know, I mean, the comic books that you do create yourself, and you create a lot of great ones. Do you have a place on your wall for the ones that you've done yourself?
No, that gets kind of, I don't know. I feel kind of weird about having them on the wall, but now having pointed out that that my wife is sitting right over here, I have a lot of her art. Colleen Coover is my wife, and I have a lot of her art on the wall because she's literally my favorite artist in the world. So I like to put her art up.
But good answer.
I don't think she likes it on the wall that much. First of all, like some of it I remember so nostalgically. So some of it is like 20 years old, and she's, you know, rightfully become a far better artist since then. So I walk by and have like these fond memories of, oh, look at that beautiful piece. And she's like, yeah, look how I drew that arm. Whoa, come on.
But I would say that's a very good answer that you gave that saves you for the day for when, but yeah, I will say, as you know, for my comics, I will say I do have a vanity wall. It wasn't the space image. You see the like comic books behind me. Cause you know, I'm some writers arrogant shit. I'm like, hey, look, my shit. But, mm-hmm. But yeah, it must be amazing to not only have that love for comic books all going back from the Golden Age, but supplying your own, such as My Date with Monsters. It must be a hell of a feeling.
Yeah, it does feel good. Like getting fan mail is big for me. And like the ones that, like, I love doing the horror stuff, like Bunny Mask and Colder are two of my all-time favorite, and My Date with Monsters. But I also do like all ages stuff, like the Plants vs. Zombies graphic novels. And the fan mail I get from those is often means the most to me, because there are mothers that will say, my child literally learned how to read so that he could read your comic, or, you know, a picture of a kid holding up a Plants vs. Zombies graphic novel and, you know, saying, this is literally the first thing I've ever read in my life. And it's like, that's kind of heartwarming, and I feel the responsibility there. So yeah, it does feel good to be a creator.
It definitely must. And so your current one is My Date with Monsters. Can you give our listeners your pitch for the series, giving a sense of what the story's about?
Basically, it's about a woman who became involved with dream research, and it went entirely wrong. And dreams have broken through into the world. And the world has sort of gotten used to it. Now and then they have dream breakouts, and they're always nightmares. They're monsters that come in, and they're dangerous. But there are ways to go around it. There's some pills called Blanket, which allow you to sleep without dreams. But there are certain focal points in the world that if they could close, they could close the dreams, the nightmares. And Risa, the main character, her daughter, Maki is one of those focal points. And each of the focal points has a certain way of getting it solved. And it's solved their trauma, basically. And Maki wants her mother, Risa, the main character, to fall in love. So while Risa is fighting monsters and trying to save the world, she's also trying to meet a guy that's not a complete jerk so she can fall in love.
So as you mentioned, the pill blanket that stops people from having dreams, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the impact on not dreaming for the individual? Because I mean, most of us do have dreams. Some of us have dreams that we have and definitely maybe even cherish that we've had at night. Losing the ability to dream, what is the impact on that on the individual?
The blanket pills are pretty good with that. We actually deal with that in the series, that a lot of dream suppressants really are not healthy for you, because like you say, there's reasons you dream and it interrupts your sleep if you're not dreaming and things like that. So long-term effects of not dreaming are very bad for you. The blanket pills kind of do a substitute in a way and allow the chemicals and things like that. But it is something that, depending on how far we go into it, I will say that blanket pills are better for you, but that doesn't mean that they're great, you know?
Yeah.
So it is a long-term thing.
So the nightmares that you said that get unleashed, especially while people are dreaming, are they specific to the dreamer or are they just a doorway of where the nightmares enter, but the nightmares that enter the physical world, not necessarily connected to the dreams of that dreamer?
They're more just a doorway. The person having a nightmare opens a doorway. We haven't really dealt with, and I don't really plan on, like, you know, it being tinged with the dreamer itself, because they are literally opening a doorway to another door, so or to another world. So I don't want them, like the nightmares, to say, oh, this guy also had a, you know, a top hat in his dream. Well, I'll put on a top hat. They're not here to perform or to play a role. They're here to well, that's actually why they're here, is one of the big parts of the series that we'll get to in later issues.
I mean, I just love the idea of discussing and and looking into the dreams and the nightmare worlds. I mean, that's such a fascinating concept, because I think that's something that we all share, but there's such a uniqueness and there's such a fantasy-esque aspect to dreams that I think it's just amazing that you get to explore in your story.
Yeah, I'm quite fascinated with dreams. I'm a person who dreams a lot. Like I have wild epic dreams almost on a nightly basis, and a nightmare maybe every week or so. While my wife rarely remembers her dreams, you know, she probably gets really bored when I wake up and say, "So last night, here's what happened," you know, and things like that. Because, you know, hearing, listening to someone talk about their dreams can be kind of boring.
my wife likes to share her dreams, but I will say they're fascinating in case she listens. In case she ever decides to tune in, I'll be like, they are fascinating to listen.
They're
to.
They're just absolutely fascinating. Yeah.
Of course they are. But I mean, that must be an exciting thing for you to experience these dreams on a regular basis, like especially the epic ones. It must be such a interesting, or maybe even motivational sense of going to sleep and experiencing that, and what you come out with when you do wake up, that those, and I think me as well, very rarely remembers their dreams, don't get to enjoy.
Yeah, it is enjoyable. I even have like serial dreams where like they're episodic, like, you know, there's houses or adventures that I go on that like, not necessarily the next night, but maybe a month later, I'll pick up from there and the adventure continues and things like that. So yeah, it's kind of like subscribing to a series.
You know, it's like your brain's doing the writing for you. You wake up, you're like, that's my next story right there. Thank you, brain.
Thank you, brain. there are times when I wake up and I remember a line or something that somebody said in a dream, and I'm like, that is a better line than I have ever written awake. What is going on?
So for now, you got to have your pages while you're sleeping, see if you can sleep write your next story and let your brain handle it.
I used to put a little notepad near my bed so I could write down stuff and remember it, and I gave it up because a lot of the time I would just be too sleepy to do it. But like one morning I woke up and I had remembered that, like, oh, I remember writing it down because it was such a good, I couldn't remember the dream itself, but I remembered how fascinating and wonderful it was. and I picked up my notepad and I had written down cowboy fire, and I'd circled it several times and wrote important. And I'm like, what is this? And I realized then that my sleepy, like 3 a.m, you know, mind was never going to cohesively write down my ideas.
Oh, I will say I have made the mistake a few times of waking up in the middle of the night with a great just scenes of dialogue in my head, you know, like wake up with, because you know, for some of the stories I work on, I'm like, man, I'm gonna remember that when I wake up, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, in a few hours I wake up, I'm just like, I have none. Nope. Of it. I got nothing. I know there was an idea, I knew the dialogue was just how I wanted to write it,
right?
And I made the mistake of going right back to bed and I blew it all.
I do that in the daytime sometimes when I'm just like, you know, sitting around, and I'll get an idea and I'm like, that is such a beautiful idea that there's no reason for me to write it down because I will remember it forever. And then like 20 minutes later, I'm like, nah, gone.
Yeah, you really got to do it at that exact moment. Like there's a moment of inspiration where everything is just right. And mm-hmm. the moment that slips, it's like losing, you know, like your remote control in the couch, or you're like, you can never find it. It's gone forever.
Exactly.
But I think one of the interesting, I think I love about your story is the idea of focal points and having to overcome trauma to close the focal points. Mm-hmm. And one question I do have, maybe because it's based, maybe the question came from myself, because I'm kind of a pessimistic person who's very rarely like satisfied with things. And what do you do about the people who are just not easily satisfied, you know, made happy and lovely? Some people are just inherently miserable people.
I mean, yeah, so far I haven't dealt with any focal points like that. It's been like very, like one person wanted to be famous, one person wanted to be rich, one person just wanted to be left alone. But yeah, some people, like you say, are a little more complex. It's not a, you know, it's not a A, B, 1, 2 binary solution. So, and I think RISA is, you know, by far the most complicated, because it's not like solving her, or solving Maki, the daughter who has the trauma, just wants her mom to be in love. That's, being in love is not a binary thing either. It's not like, you know, especially I think, like a 12-year-old, Maki is 12, their version of what adult love means can often be, you know, the white horse and the prince and the princess and things like that. And everybody will be, you know, happy 100% of the time. And if two people argue, then obviously they're not in love. Like, how could two people who are arguing be in love? You know, things like that. So RISA is by far the hardest to solve. And RISA isn't really that much in the idea of being in love either. So,
well, I mean, RISA obviously knows that her happiness or in this relationship connects to closing the focal point in Maki. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, dating is hard enough as it is. Making a connection is hard enough as it is. The pressure for RISA to know that she kind of has to fall in love to cut this out, how bad does that complicate the emotion? Because once again, it's not just the natural, I mean, it's going to be all dated that there's a natural effect when you meet with someone and it's just, you know, it just clicks. But the pressure added onto that, you are trying to force it to happen. Mm-hmm. How much does that complicate Reza's ability to find that person?
Hugely. I hate to give a one-word answer, but yeah, it's huge. Because once you're told to do something, your natural response is to, or at least mine is, just to, you know, fight against it, depending what I'm told, you know, if it's
right.
If I'm told, hey, pick up that chocolate chip cookie and eat it, it's like, yeah, we can reach an accord.
Right.
You know, but if it's like, do this, you know, hard thing, then I'm like, I'm going to rebel against it. So she does have problems with that, which she talks through with Maki to a certain extent. And then, Croak, who's a troll, who's a main character.
Great character. About,
and she talks about it with him a lot. In a way, he's an actual monster, but in a way, her really only confidant, because she can trust to the level that she can trust with him, whereas everybody else, she doesn't know the level of trust.
And I think there's also an added difficulty is that the army is trying to groom men and women to get RISA to fall in love with them. Mm-hmm. And once again, on the other side, having to stage happiness, maybe, or like love on the other end for the gentleman or woman who's RISA is supposed to be set up with. Once again, that must further complicate the issue, because how do you possibly act natural in that situation where you're being trained and in the pressure that this is your moment to try to save the world. I mean, is this doomed to failure just because you can't just make this happen that way?
I don't want to say it's doomed to failure, but it's let's face it, failure is the default setting for most relationships. Any success,
that is true.
You know, any success is wildly wonderful. So yeah, everything is hard in this comic.
Well, I mean, before I met my wife, something I would say, I'm wonderful at failing dates. I'd be mm-hmm. really bad at them. I've had a long history of failures at dates. What I would always say is, you only have one successful relationship in your entire life. Because by just definition, you married the one that's your successful one. Everything else ends in failure. Even if you married and divorced, that was your failure. Only one relationship ever ends successfully.
Right.
And just the odds that you can try to force it to happen, I can't imagine how that increasing anyone's percentage of anything.
Yeah. But then again, it's like, you know, it's like a 1 in a million chance versus a 1 in 5 million chance. It's like, yeah, the odds are worse, but doesn't make much difference.
Well, the character I really like, I'm gonna get back to Reza, but one character I really like, you said, Croak, the troll from the Nightmare World. Mm-hmm. If the nightmares are being closed off by focal points, does at some point that mean that Croak is destined to have to be to leave our realm because of these closures? And is that a benefit to him, or does he realize that's a cost?
I don't think it makes much difference to him one way or the other. He's actually, like, in a way, a classic troll, the ones that, you know, dwell beneath the bridge. He's actually called, his real name is Hethri the Bridge Dweller. He sort of hangs out beneath the bridge between the two realities. And mostly he just gets hungry and wants to eat things. And what he eats isn't that big a deal for him. So if it closes, he can stay in one world it's not that big a deal to him. He likes Risa, but at the same time, he has other friends too. He's the most casual character.
And well, like I said, I think another way is that I think you do a genius method of making these characters relatable. Mm-hmm. For instance, with Risa, you have her fighting, I believe I'm going to pronounce it correctly, a shrike. Am I pronouncing that correct?
Yes,
a shrike. But is worried about getting home in time so the babysitter doesn't charge her extra, you know, overtime. And I thought to myself, once again, what a nice, relatable way to make that character feel identifiable for every reader, because, you know, budgets, and I'm sure every parent, I'm not one of a parent, but I'm sure most parents look at that and go, I'd definitely be like, you know what, leave the shrike. I can't afford the extra time and a half for that babysitter. And, you know, is that one of the ways you were thinking about how to make Risa and this situation, which is something, once again, we never in our lives are used to, you know, we're not gonna fight real monsters, we're not really at that level, but to make the character feel identifiable to us, those are like the little touches you were thinking, how can I do this? How can I make Risa feel real to everybody else?
Yeah, that's something I like to do in all my writing. It's like the characters are the most important thing to me, so they need to feel real. And in order to feel real, they sort of have to have a completely rounded personality. Like anybody who's just constantly thinking about one thing to me is a boring character, and I don't really care about them. If someone is 100% of the time thinking, you know, I have to, you know, stop Dr., you know, bad guy and save the world, you know, it's like, but don't you get hungry in the meantime? You know, are you aware that you have 37 unread texts on your phone? Who are these from? You know, some of them are going to be, you know, about your car warranty or whatever, like stupid stuff. But, you know, some of them are going to be, you know, a friend you haven't seen in 10 years saying, hey, do you want to get together? I'm going to be in town and things like that. And I think a character, in order to be fully rounded and believable, needs to care about those things too. Even if it's I don't have time for that right now, Dr. Bad Guy is, you know, fighting the solar ray or whatever. You have to have more than one emotion or it's just terrible for me. Like in the superhero genre, there was a long period, it's past now, where I thought Batman was the most boring character in comics. And during that time period, there was an actual editorial rule that no matter what, Batman could not smile. He could never smile. Okay. And it was like, but he ought to be able to. He's doing some good things, you know, he's saving people and things like that. And it's like, once you reduce a character to a single emotion or a single, you know, pathway of characterization, they don't feel real to me. And then I don't care who wins a fight. I don't care if they, you know, win the day or things like that. Batman can smile these days, by the way. So it's better now. And I think you have to, like, if you don't believe in a character, why would you believe in the story of that character?
No, I agree 100%. I mean, you do have to be drawn to that character. I mean, Batman obviously has the backing of 10, 20, 30 years of growing up with the character to give you that automatic connection. Mm-hmm. The difficulty of writing a story like you are from, you know, that no one's been familiar with, is that you got to connect them from scratch instead of building on, you know, your childhood playing with the toys of Batman automatically makes you comfortable with Batman. I mean, one of the reasons why I probably love DC is that when I grew up, I had the DC toys, and, you know, you just kind of automatically connect to them a little bit because mm-hmm. You remember playing with them. But once again, you got to connect them with characters who we've never heard of, experienced. And your story is unique in the sense that I don't think we can relate your story to another story that we remember because it's too unique for that. Really, I really was impressed with how you made your character relatable like that.
Thank you.
And I think the cool thing is that it made me think of the characters as people and really wonder about what's going on in their heads, which is mm-hmm. not always easy to do because, you know, they're characters, they're not real. So sometimes you don't give a shit, but sometimes you want to know.
Right.
And one thing I was thinking about Risa is, again, you said she is a lot of what's going on is because of her, mm-hmm. What she did. People are dying due to the nightmares killing them. All through society, there's blanket that had to get made to, you know, slow down dreaming or stop dreaming completely. How does that affect Risa as a person, knowing that the weight of all that is on her?
Quite a lot. That's part of why she goes out and fights the monsters personally. She's basically, I don't think I've ever stated or will ever state this, but she's really the only person that the blanket pills don't work on. That's why Croak basically stays in her room every night, because she will have nightmares and nightmares will be born. Mm. But it's kind of handy because Croak is always hungry. So he just has, you know, a set meal every night. Mm. But yeah, she has nightmares on a nightly basis and basically daymares in a way, because she does feel responsible. She's not technically responsible. It was her husband, but she was a part of the entire thing. So, you know, she has the I was there guilt and I should have stopped it guilt.
So, and also in the world with, like, so you have Croak and some of these guys who can move through nightmares and enter our world. Is the reverse possible? Can humans then enter through a gate and back into the nightmare world?
That gets answered later.
Okay.
It's a big part of it. Short answer is a bridge is a bridge. Yeah.
That sounds fantastic. Like, have you ever thought about if you could physically enter one of your own? I know you experienced it as a dream. Have you thought ever, or do you imagine what it would be like to enter it literally?
Like enter one of my own dreams?
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes. I don't have them as much anymore, but I used to have what they call waking dreams, where I would be in like a different world, but I would still be cognizant. And I could actually change the world and kind of move through the world and mold it to my own things. And so that's, you know, I guess as close as you can come, but, you know, maybe in the future we'll be able to record our dreams and then put them all in 3D and, you know, get in there in VR, you know, virtual reality, and kind of walk through our own dreams. Seems like I've seen, you know, some technology that seems like in the future that'll be possible. It's really, you know, beginning, there's not much to it technology, but as a guy who was, you know, around when like the video game Pong came out, you know, it's like Pong versus today's video games. It's like I've seen technology grow in huge ways, so it's fascinating to be able to think about like the literal possibility of walking into your own dreams.
And like I said, and I think I really am enjoying the layers of your story, and I think one part of your story I really did like, you kind of touch on a little bit, but I kind of want to revisit just a little bit. Croak is very intelligent. He states that love's not a light switch that can just be turned on. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you obviously have the government trying to switch that light on the, you know, automatically with, you know, their right. training session. And I think, as you're kind of mentioning that, yeah, scientists and how they think and how government thinks, I kind of find like they're existing in a realm of logic, not emotion. And it's a very, I like the idea that, there's a great line from West Wing. I can't quite remember it, but it had to do with, if the government had to cure polio, they create the greatest like oxygen chamber ever, but not a cure for polio. So the government just can't quite exist and manipulate into the world of an emotion, because governments don't think that way. Think in terms of logic, yes or no, like the army mm-hmm. does. So is that kind of like where you're going with that part of the story, trying to focus, you know, trying to represent how it will never work in this way because the government can't enter in existence of emotion. They don't think in terms of compassion that way.
Or yeah, to a certain degree. Like you were just talking about scientists. Like I'm huge. I love science. Yes. I read science websites on a nightly basis. But I have noticed that like a scientist can be good or bad, but a group of scientists can be mundane or bad. They don't have like the move forward. And I feel that way about governments to a certain degree as well, is like you can have good and bad people, but if you get 1,000 good people together and form a government, they probably won't do good things because they will just mesh, you know, fight against each other on the right way to do a good thing. I don't think that the government's plan to have Risa fall in love has any possibility, but the only possibility we present in it is there's one guy who thinks it's all crap, so he's a possibility.
By the word I was looking for was Iron Lung. I said oxygen, I meant Iron Lung.
I heard Iron Lung in my head, so
yeah, because
that's what you were talking about.
That's what I was going with, and then it popped after I said oxygen. But either way, it's a great line. And I want to thank you for doing something in your story that I thought was really, I really just appreciate it. I'm a pet owner. Mm-hmm. You know, I love my dog to death. And the fact that you acknowledge the dreaming of dogs and to the extent where they are can also be gateways themselves and nightmares, I thought it was just like a great nod to dogs and the ability for animals to, you know, that acknowledge that they are, you know, intelligent enough to dream.
Yeah.
And it was such an intelligent thing to throw in the story, to put in the story.
Well, my wife and I watched pet videos a lot. We don't have a pet, but it's like, there's all sorts of videos where you can tell a dog is dreaming. It's like he's fetching a ball right now, or what is he doing right now? <He's>, you know, things like that. But their little legs are always kicking, you know, as they come across, you know. And yeah, they're certainly intelligent enough to have dreams.
Well, I guess this is the question that I think some of the audience may ask. Do cats then dream in your story? I don't think I've ever seen a cat dream, so, but it's an important question.
Deal with cats, but yeah, I think they would dream. But I don't know. I love cats, but I see them a lot more Machiavellian than I. Yes.
I mean, that seems to be like the popular opinion of cats. That, yeah, you know that you know, you never really see, like I said, a cat dream. You know, at least in my opinion, I never think I've ever seen one dream before.
Yeah,
but maybe they do. Who really knows?
They would be very different in dreams. I wrote a graphic novel once called "I Was the Cat," and it was about a cat. Who is using his 9 lives to take over the world. And a lot of people loved it. And they wanted me to do a follow-up called "I Was the Dog," where a dog tries to take over the world. And I was like, there's no real story there, because the dog would just go, here's my plan. I'll be friends with everybody. Everybody will be my friend. It's like, that's not a story. That's just a happy dog, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking, based on your ideas of focal points and making the person happy to shut the focal point, can a dog be a focal point then? And when is a dog not happy? So when would it not ever close? I mean, a dog would be like, you know, dog focal point. Okay, here's a pet on the head. Close, we're good.
Everything's fine now.
Everything's good now. I mean,
don't have any pets as focal points. maybe in the future, it's an idea.
I just was wondering, like, can a dog ever not be happy enough to leave a focal point open for any length of time? They're such happy little animals.
Yeah. Or when you're not giving them a slice of pizza, though, is about them.
the 5 seconds when the door may open for just that one moment.
Right.
But one of the cool villains of the story, in issue two, I believe, is, I'm probably gonna pronounce it wrong, Chubb.
Chubb
is a very interesting villain. And is this an overarching villain that's going to be over multiple stories? Is that like the big bad of the series? Is this
it's definitely Chubb is basically the first five issues for sure. And I wanted to have a real simple name for a character. I see like so many horror stories that I would like, but then, you know, they introduce the bad guy or whatever, the nightmare creature, and it's always, you know, the darkness slice of, you know, blah blah blah, and I'm like, just calm down. First of all, if somebody wants to be creepy, you know, there's no way for a creepy person to come up and give you their, you know, I am, and then speak for 5 minutes on their title. It's like, dude, just calm down, you kind of blew it, now you just seem pretentious, you know. They're like a...
So what motivates Chubb?
That actually is kind of a secret of the series.
Okay.
So I don't want to touch too much on it. But there is a motivation, and it's not just, boy, I like killing. He does like killing, but that's not his motivation.
So all these nightmares that live in the nightmare or in the dream realm, they lived their this realm before any focal points were open, anything like that. They've lived their entire existence in this nightmare realm. Live, die. I don't know if they have old age or they don't old age. I mean, I don't know, but they definitely live their entire lives in this nightmare realm.
Mm-hmm.
What are the motivations of these type of creatures like? Like, do they have motivations like we have motivations? Do they have the same goals that kind of like humans would have goals? Or is it because it's a realm that they're used to, what was available to complete them existed in that realm, and all this is something beyond that? I mean, how does that all work?
Well, it's not their first time here, because it's like, even though the nightmare realms have opened, dreams have opened them before. But this is, again, I don't want to touch too much on this, because to explain their motivations would kind of touch on some stuff in the fifth issue that I don't really want to talk about publicly yet, because I want it to be in the fifth issue. But they do have, they have a world, and they like their world. It's a strange world. I mean, Hethry Croak walks through those worlds a lot, so we get to see the world to a certain degree. And he actually, like you mentioned, can humans go there? He takes people through it occasionally. There's a visit with Hethry, and there's a visit with a couple other people.
That's
so
cool.
So we know that they're weird. They're weird worlds. I can remember telling when I wrote the script for some of the first appearances of their world, I gave Andy McDonald, my co-creator, the artist, a whole bunch of reference of Steve Ditko's Doctor Strange worlds, because they're so bizarre. It just looks so weird. And it's like, they're not just like, I see so many like other worlds that are like, oh, the trees look different, you know? And it's like, that doesn't feel like another world. That feels like a different colored world, or, you know? And I want bizarre, you know, the physics of Earth don't work there. So, and Steve Ditko was good at designing those worlds, so we kind of took some of our cues from him.
So is My Day with Monsters, is that a limited series that's an ongoing? Is it an ongoing sort of like ongoing limited story?
The first five issues is what we're considering an arc, and then we're going to see how schedules work out after that. We're all so busy. but I have a lot of stories, so, and stuff that happens in the fifth issue actually opens up more stories. So,
well, like I said, I think it's so far you've done a great job of writing the story. The third issue for our listeners came out on the 19th, I believe. Mm-hmm. And this is going to hit monthly. Consistently, I assume. So next one will be February. So I just want to thank you so much, Mr. Tobin. You've written a great storyline. I enjoyed the series very much, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, sir. Have a fantastic night.
You too.